In native vocabulary, there are distinct classes of mountains. There are little mountains, lick lick, big mountains, big pella, and very big mountains, drei pella. We had come to learn the difference. We knew to make adjustments. A little mountain to Alice was likely to be a long, hard climb to us. A big mountain to Alice would come close to killing us. A drei pella mountain we had yet to see, and if Alice was to be believed, we would not see one this side of Engati. We went on down the trail and soon began to ascend a mountain. We took a me lolo. Now Mia Mel and Alice were talking. "Alice, how far is Engati?" Mia Mel asked. "Long way," he replied. Sitten and I looked at each other, our eyes glowing a mutual red. As we resumed the walking, we entered a certain mental, physical, spiritual state, the state of extreme fatigue. I had known it before, but it had been a long time. Sitten and I, to impassive observers, might have resembled 90-year-old arthritic men. Our movements were immeasurably slow, our horse demands for rest frequent. We seemed to be going distinctly upward when, of course, Alice had assured Mia Mel that there were no more mountains to encounter. We drank, we rested, we ordered halts. The boys were impatient, but we could not help it. And now, at each break, I lay down and my mind instantly took flight. I was back in Amite County, driving my red pickup truck along a gravel road between vast ranks of fragrant pine trees. Or was I at home, sitting at the table, devouring creamy whole milk and cornbread made from stone ground meal? Awake, jungle, fatigue, buckling legs, brilliant purple leaves, hidden sky, constant new climbs, rapid descents to rocky streams, sharp climb again, darkness, dampness, butterflies, a melange of sounds, purplish, bluish spots before the eyes. Me lolo, me lolo. Cornbread and milk. My wife, my son, a bed, things familiar and comfortable, scenes of rest and satiation. And on our feet again. I lost count of the mountains crossed and ceased to catalog them as Lick Lick or Big Pella. The smallest hill became all too Big Pella to me. With nothing but misinformation on its location, Engati had become a mirage ever lurking around the trail's next bend. But Engati lurked around no bend that day, we soon discovered. It was 5, the time for halt in the jungle, and we had reached a garden. It was no garden such as will be found on the outskirts of a village. It was simply a patch of modified jungle. By way of amenities, there was a very old, very browned, ant-ridden lean-to made of banana leaves. It was set there in the midst of the garden, cow-cow and pumpkin vines sprawling out among banana trees to the edge of the jungle a short distance away. Wild pigs apparently had rooted up every single cow-cow in the garden, but had left plenty of pumpkins and their vines, which make excellent greens. Then there were the tree crops, cooking bananas and unripe pawpaws. And there was the wild fruit maritus, a long red phallus of a fruit or vegetable, which grows high in trees and reportedly signifies in Menyamya manhood rituals. It is also a delicacy to them, and one or two were knocked down and cut up to be cooked in a pot. The boys were in a native's candy store, eyes wide and eager, shouting back and forth to one another. They scampered out into the garden, returning with clumps of green bananas, long green and yellow gourd-shaped pumpkins, heaps of greens, a stray mooli, and unripe pawpaw. Sitten and I moseyed out in search of a swimming hole. Alice wandered with us, looking for something. Sometimes we felt friendly toward him. He followed us as we walked down through the jungle to the river, which swarmed and tumbled and roared 20 feet below us, down the sheer mud bank. No swimming here. Alice had told us we couldn't swim there. Now he stood by to gloat and grin. But we felt friendly anyway. opposite and joked with him, as he always jokes with natives, and though he was weak with that day's malaria attack, he launched into a mock scuffle with Alice at the river's edge, each pretending to try to toss the other one over. They grinned, grimaced, and sweated in this half-serious tussle, Alice's tenacious strength belying his puny size. It would have been a close contest had they been serious. Alice was all wire and mountain muscle, though there was scarcely half an ounce of him. Sitton's larger size, like mine, was weakened by white man softness. The wrestling match ended, and Sitton and I went on down the trail to the last stream crossed half a mile away. It was all mud and mosquitoes, and we did not tarry long. Back in the garden, we spread our sleeping bags under the shelter where there was room for all of us but three. Those three were Leonard, Ocklo, and Vincent, by law of aggressive character, and they built a new banana leaf shelter nearby. The boys built a fire and the cooking of a feast began. This was Indian-style feast or famine, and here in the lap of luxury, we decidedly were going to feast. This was a type of garden, I later learned, made by villagers at a distance from their village. They will go there, chop and burn the trees over a 5-acre or so patch, plant their crops, erect a lean-to, then abandon the garden, a new miniature jungle, until such time they figure the crops will be ripe. By that time, the wildlings of the forest, pigs, birds, tree kangaroos, will have feasted as well, often robbing the entire crop of cow-cow. The presence of such a garden was not necessarily a sign of proximity to a village. It offered hope of nothing except a full belly. It was an emerald set in the jungle's flounces, just as at noon the previous day we had luxuriated amid tropical fruits. Tonight there would be vegetable opulence. It was growing dark, but for once we could see the clear blue sky and could view the edges of the jungle rather than the inside of its belly. It was lovely from such a short distance, the very picture of dark, sheltering endlessness. It whirred with unknown creatures, twinkling with butterflies and chance blooms. The fire crackled and glowed. Hard times were no more. True, we had now been 4 days on foot and had yet to reach Angati, but Alice assured us we most certainly would get there tomorrow, probably by noon, even if we did not walk strong. Though out of rice, we had more food than we could consume. The boys were playful, their somber moods dispelled along with the jungle gloom in the last breath of genuine daylight. The sun was gone. It was day's most exquisite time. Marita's steamed pumpkin boiled. Bananas and greens had been stuffed into segments of bamboo and now lay roasting in the fire. Vincent was carving more pumpkin for the pot. Mia Mel was fashioning a concoction of tinned fish, greens, and pumpkin. The air for the first time was pleasantly cool. Alice was friendly, talkative, almost fluent now in pidgin as he joked along with us all. Sitton and I lazed in the lean-to, I writing in my journal, he reading, waiting for supper. Then it was ready, and we got up and sat around the fire with the boys, eating pumpkin and bananas. As I sat there, half a steaming banana in my mouth, I heard the weird, shrill cry of some atonal jungle entity. Entranced, I felt its inhuman heartlessness contrast with the exuberant laughter of the boys. Beyond our circle, its strange menace circled patiently in its own designs. The sound was like a wicked premonition, voiced by the jungle itself, ignored by everyone but me. I sat there a while, awed by the sound, my mind distracted from the cheerful voices around me. I was drawn for a moment to the jungle's black heart, for the jungle has a heart, as black and impenetrable as death. The secret it was whispering held me mesmerized, but what that secret was, I couldn't discern. At last, I asked the boys what that sound was. Peterson looked up and listened momentarily. Oh, that was just a type of bird, insect, or butterfly, he said. Something in the bush. Oh, so that's what it is. I turned back to the warm ring of food and companionship. It was a long evening. Mia Mel shared his fish, greens, pumpkin concoction with Sithen and me, and few better dishes have I eaten. It was salty and flavorful. I tried the maritas. The heavily seeded red fruit had been cut into chunks and steamed, then mashed into a paste and doused with salt. This paste is scooped into the mouth, savored, and the seeds spat out. It was bland to me, but to the boys it was highly prized. After we ate, we sat around the fire in the darkness for a while, then began retiring to our pallets. The joking, laughing, and hooting went on a long time. Pidgin is a great language for joking, and New Guineans love to kid. I got out my harmonica and played my hat full of tunes. Camptown Races, Amazing Grace, Clementine, and so forth. It had clouded up, so the truism about rain was no longer a comfort. Some time before dawn, as we slept, the rain burst forth in an icy gush. Sitton and I were sleeping on inflated air mattresses, whose grooves provided excellent stream beds for the water to run under us, soaking our sleeping bags. The ground was no better. The lean-to, of course, merely slowed the rain a little, nothing more, so soon we were soaked through with the bitter, cold mountain rain. I had spread my poncho over me, but the rain ran in rivers under me, so there was nothing to do but to sleep on anyway. After the rain slackened, Sitton got up and went over to help Aklo and Vincent. Their shelter, too, was worthless. Kindle a fire. Peterson got up, too. Like the others, his only bedding was a sheet to warm up. Sitton curled up by the fire and slept, as I did in the cold sleeping bag in the lean-to. Later, in the deep blue light before dawn, under the dripping white moon, I got up, wrung out Sitton's wool blanket, and spread it over him. Soon afterward, we all got up. Alice rolled up his meager belongings and quickly roasted some bananas over the fire to eat while the rest of us packed. Finally, we joined him to roast a pumpkin and bananas for breakfast. But by then, Alice had finished. He gulped down the last bit of banana, hot too, grabbed his bag, and took off into the jungle. For him, the day had started. We shouted after him to wait, but of course he could not understand Pidgin. So we stayed and finished the rest of our food, then hoisted our packs and set out to find the trail. But it was not so simple. A trail will enter a garden at one end, and like a broken thread, the other end will pick up somewhere, anywhere else. We saw the direction he headed, but could only guess at a trail in the labyrinth of weeds and fallen logs. "Alice, Alice, wait, come back," the boys were shouting. "We can't find the trail." But Alice was gone, and even had he heard us, it is doubtful that he could have understood such complicated pidgin phrases. So we opted for a likely-looking fallen log, wandered its length, then set off down what might or might not have been a trail into the jungle. It was a bad start in a series of bad starting days. To make it worse, Sitton again was suffering from malaria. I was angry, as I had been off and on during the past several days, and like Sitton, I often fantasized about thrashing Alice. But slogging into the jungle to the creak of aching muscles, by the time we caught up with Alice, a mile into the jungle, I felt only relief at finding him. Nevertheless, I lectured them all. "David is sick," I said. "He was staggering with his malaria. It's no good that we walk fast. Do you want him to come up with a big sick?" I addressed Alice. "Alice, David is sick, malaria. Do you savvy malaria?" He shook his head, wide-eyed, obviously not savvying. "He has a sick," I said slowly and clearly. Ah, he understood. His eyes were very sympathetic for poor David. "If we walk fast, he will come up very big sick. We must walk easy, easy." We must not walk strong. We must melolo. Otherwise, David will come up with a big, thick true, and we won't be able to go anywhere. Do you want that to happen? No, no one wanted that to happen. They sat chastened, meek, and impatient, while Sitton leaned against a tree, eyes shut, feet in the cool water of a stream, sweat beaded on his pallid forehead. And so for a while everyone walked slowly, but then everyone began disappearing again. Everyone, that is, except Peterson, who yesterday had taken up the habit of walking behind Sitton and me in the manner of a herdsman to see that we didn't fall or lose the way. That particularly applied to Sitton, who had been weak with malaria. I was a good distance in front of Sitton and Peterson, and by now all the boys were out of sight ahead of me again. The trail here ran through flat jungle, dipping down to cross creeks, crowded with undergrowth. Presumably there was here an ancient established trail, but it had become so overgrown that Alice found it necessary to hack through it with his bush knife. So the new trail often consisted of no more than occasional slashed twigs. Usually I could follow it, but when I came to a creek where there was a break in the vegetation, it was difficult, sometimes impossible, to pick up the thread on the other side. Sometimes I would have to shout for someone to come back, or I would wait for Peterson to come up and find it. Nor was it a simple matter for the others. During the past 2 days, Alice had lost the trail more than once and had to backtrack. Following it alone took for me an almost intuitive vision. It was comparable to trailing deer. You squint your eyes, don't really look at it, and often the trail comes into focus, much as in looking at the dim stars, which only appear when you look to one side. The trouble here was that I had to walk very slowly to do this, creeping along, and I soon got disgusted with the game. So it was time for another harangue. Stick together, etc., like talking to billy goats, walking slowly, went contrary to their biological clocks. The land became more broken now as we entered another hilly section. I had followed my compass ever since we left the Wahtut, and we had hewn to an almost perfect southwest course. Once we reached the fallen hut at the foot of the mountain 2 nights before, however, we had angled toward the north. We were continuing so this morning, but soon we began to turn back to the southwest, into the mountains again. The northward line apparently had run between two ranges of mountains. It was mid-morning, and Gotti should be soon. We came to the river, or a tiny gushing tributary of it, one of its heads, and stopped for a rest. We had just climbed and descended a big hill. As we sprawled out there in the sun, the air cool, we no longer felt eager to clamber into the icy water, but we drank freely of it. Meanwhile, Alice undid his hobo bundle and took out the filthy sheet which was his bedding. He soaked it in the water, then stretched it flat on a wide rock in the sun. Taking his bar of soap, he began scrubbing the sheet furiously. It was laundry time. After he soaked it, he washed it out in the river again and spread it out on the rock to dry. Then he began washing himself after a fashion. He splashed water on his face and in his hair, blinking and sputtering. "We must be getting close," Sitton muttered. "Usually when they start to cleaning up like that, they're getting close to their village." I figured he was probably right. He wasn't. The trail from the creek led alarmingly upward at an angle heretofore unsurpassed. It was an angle that suggested a revelation of the meaning of Drea Pella. As we began the climb, I glanced up, way, way up, and saw through the jungle a small patch of light where the summit must be. It was a long, long way there, on a trail that zigzagged steeply. It was no longer the usual difficult walk. Now we had to use hands as well as feet, grabbing roots and saplings to pull ourselves up. Meanwhile, we had come at last to the land of leeches. The little blood suckers, which the boys called lick-lick snakes, dropped off onto our pants, boots, arms, hands, and shirts. This is Rakamunda, said Sitten, acknowledging at last that this trail was as bad as the trail to Rakamunda in Enga province. Until now, Rakamunda had held the crown for being the worst patrol in Sitten's experience. Now he conceded that the only differences were that Rakamunda's leeches were bigger and the air at that higher altitude was colder. Rakamunda was where Sitten had got broken in thoroughly. He had arrived from Corpus Christi eager and adventurous, clamoring to take on the roughest patrols. First, he went with the indefatigable Joe Cannon via another route to Aiwamba. Sitten and another young man became virtually incapacitated with dysentery, malaria, and fatigue, while Cannon twiddled his thumbs impatiently, waiting on those young bucks to catch up. Cannon was in his 50s. He had learned to suffer hardship and keep on slogging anyway. Rakamunda is in cooler, higher, if not steeper, country. With a string of carriers and school students, Sitten had set out on the three-day hike to the village of Rakamunda and found the trail much as we were finding this one. Only then it was cold and eternally raining. It was there that he ultimately passed out from fatigue, woke with water rising in his face, and found his carriers and schoolboys all gone, leaving him with the luggage. A few patrols of that caliber sufficed to change Sitten's conception of patrols from adventure to work. Such patrols also left his health broken for a time. Now he was back on the trail again. His malaria had slackened this morning, and his strength had returned in measure, which was fortunate as we attacked this skyscraper of a mountain. I assuaged myself with the thought of that sunny patch on the summit I had spotted when we started. It had been nearly straight above us, a towering oasis of rest. But when at last we pulled ourselves to that summit, it was only to find ourselves halfway up the mountain on a switchback with another half eternity to go. No more big mountains, eh, Alice? Whatever credibility our guide had had till then in my mind was now utterly gone. I concluded he was a flagrant and malicious liar. We reached the top, leveled out for a while in the bug-swarming jungle, then started back down on an equally steep descent. The descent did not make me happy, because I knew Ngati was on a mountaintop, and if we went down now, we would have to go back up again. But after a certain amount of frustrations and setbacks, you just learn to grit your teeth and take them, or so it seemed to me then, on our sixth day from Lehi, when our setbacks could have been enumerated on both hands. At the bottom of the mountain was another crashing head water, boulders and spray, rest and drink, sun and shade and cool air. Then, back up. The second mountain was worse than the previous, moving Alice to declare it a Dreapella mountain true, and so I came to learn the true meaning of Dreapella. At the top of it was another jungle garden with a dilapidated lean-to, vines and fruit trees, apparently untended except by wild pigs. We sprawled under the lean-to while the boys sought food. It was time for a mid-morning break. We found a stunted, half-ripe pineapple, which we quickly devoured, and several, at last, sweet moolies. Well, moolies anyway, if not sweet. They were oranges, green and sour enough to burn the lips like red peppers, but they were wet and they were citrus, and I gorged on them. The boys built a fire and roasted some cooking bananas. These staples had become all but unpalatable to me now. They had no flavor, were but gluey sticks of starch in taste, bearing no resemblance to their cousins' sweet bananas. We also ate pawpaws, which are not bad half-ripe, and soon we hit the trail again. The trail was now a series of felled logs, very big, bridging a tortuous, cleared land of neck-high weeds and ankle-breaking gullies. Balancing these logs was infinitely preferable to struggling through the cut-up gullies and high weeds. We were rarely shaded now. The network of foot logs ran across clear, hot spaces, dipping occasionally into jungle. Walking a mile on logs with a heavy pack and weary legs is not easy, but it was not harder than some of the walking we had done. Also, it indicated at last, unmistakably, that we were near Engatti. And so it was. We came at last to the edge of a ravine and saw across it a wide field beyond, which was a handful of thatched huts. Alice was shouting. Others were answering. People were gathering there on the other side of the ravine. Little people with grass loincloths, babbling in strange tongues, laughing, shouting, waving. It was afternoon. The sky was cloudy, the air cool. Our fatigue caught up with us suddenly. We had only to cross this ravine, and we would be there. Chapter 6. Engatti. We crossed the ravine and were there. Fatigue hit me as though someone had suddenly slipped rocks into my pack. In the cool air, the tiny, dirt-smeared brown people who hugged us tightly hardly seemed real. They babbled, laughed, grabbed our hands, and stroked our arms, wavering as though in a mirage. There were perhaps 6 or 8 people there to greet us, small crowd for a small village. And they were all women and children. The women were dwarfs, scarcely reaching my navel in height. They and the children seemed unaccountably happy to see us. They stroked us, sighing and murmuring, as though we were prodigal sons returning. Fatigue had hit Sitten, too, and I could see him stagger. It was over. This 2-day walk, which had taken 5 days, those mountains, Liklik, Dikpella, and Dreapella, all, at least for today and probably tomorrow. The people clustered around us as we walked across the broad field. They let us support ourselves on them as though we were old, crippled men, and they stout young boy scouts. Could they have known who we were? Did they, I wondered later, even realize that we two white skins were human beings like themselves? What was it that caused them such a babbling ecstasy? Only one of Sitten's fellow missionaries had ever been here, and that was more than 2 months ago. It seemed certain that white skins rarely, if ever, traveled here. What did Alice sing out to them when we approached? Was it simply the arrival of white skins, any white skins, that provoked such a rapturous response? The field we were crossing was a bush airstrip, a narrow, sloping, grassy field 1,000 yards long and 75 across, which the natives had diligently cleared and kept cut and trim in hopes it would someday be officially approved and airplanes would land and bring them goods. To them, in this tumbled, tangled jungle, this clear lawn was as outstanding, significant, and revolutionary as the Statue of Liberty might look to forlorn immigrants. It was their bid for the future, a future of aeroplanes, ample tobacco, cloth for shirts and lap laps, tin pots, matches, salt, knives, axes, perhaps someday a tape recorder. But I didn't know all this then as we hobbled across the strip to the cluster of huts on the other side. The village, or what there was of it here, consisted of 5 huts surrounded by gardens of cow-cow, onions, cucumbers, and tomatoes, as well as a few pawpaw and banana trees on top of a ridge overlooking vast stretches of mountain, valley, jungle, and sky with a wall of monstrous Dreapella true mountains to the southwest. There were 2 men in the village when we arrived. One was a short, wiry fellow with a tattered canvas hat, a filthy, faded black shirt, and long grass loincloth, who liked to stand in awkward ostrich poses. The other was a grinning old man in a torn purple sweater and loincloth. I say old. I mean merely venerable. It was hard to guess his age, but it would be safe to describe him as a village elder. He, unlike the other, spoke not a word of pidgin. Both men wore pig tusks in their noses. They invited us into a hut. The dwelling was well made, with a springy pit floor for crawling on and a back room for sleeping. The front room had a sandbox for a fireplace. We clambered inside with our entourage and sat in a circle around the fireplace, which some native boys quickly kindled. Now was the time for much talk and rest. When the late Australian patrol officer J.K. McCarthy first conducted exploratory patrols into Manyamya in the late 1930s, he found the parents and grandparents of the people we were now visiting. These people, according to McCarthy's lucid accounts, were among the most volatile and aggressive people ever found in Papua New Guinea. No amount of gift-giving or peacemaking seemed to impress them. They would trade sweet potatoes for axes with McCarthy's men in the morning, then bombard them with arrows and insults in the afternoon. During intervals of trading, McCarthy saw one cuckoo, as they were then called, tomahawk another as each bartered for an item. The natives frequently had fainting spells from sheer excitement. Their temperaments were as wild and explosive as dry gunpowder. They constantly devised ways of trying to kill McCarthy and his crew of armed native police. Yet during episodes of trading, some cuckoo warriors would joke with McCarthy about the previous day's battle. In short, the cuckoos were dangerous and unpredictable. McCarthy finally limped out of that country with arrow wounds, his mission of pacification a failure. Ultimately, in the few patrols since that time, the cuckoos were pacified to the extent that they stopped attacking white visitors and became more discreet about their beloved cannibalism. McCarthy established a government outpost, Manyamya Station, 4 days southwest of Engati, which had a distinct civilizing influence. But nothing could bring to a halt the bitter, eternal warfare among cuckoo clans, which was going on even now. We had heard rumors that the people of Aiwamba, 2 days to the southwest, had dispersed, taking to the hills in fear of their lives. Sitton wanted to investigate these rumors concerning his old friends. Cuckoos, now called Manyamyas, like many other bush natives, did not for a long time seem to realize that white men were human beings. White men have been fancied to be anything from spirits of natives' ancestors to wandering, dangerous ghosts. Cargo cults represent the beliefs many natives once held that white skins, being their dear departed ancestors, have returned to shower them with gifts and cargo. Soon the rucksacks, axes, knives, salt, sugar, tobacco, and clothes would be freely given to the natives. When that did not come to pass, much hostility was engendered. So now, as the children and old women stroke our arms, kissed our hands, touched our hair, and crooned with pleasure, did they see us as men or spirits? As we sat in the hut in the cool late afternoon around a crackling fire, the gestures of rapture and affection continued. When I removed my boots, an old woman kissed my feet and murmured with joy. Children stroked my arm and sniffed it. What was that pale thing? The men were less demonstrative. They were warriors, dignified. Oh, certainly they were happy to see us. When we asked if they had pawpaws, sweet moolies, anything, the fellow who spoke a pidgin sent boys to get some. Other boys took some of Sitton's dirty clothes, at his request, to the creek to wash them. Another went to fill our canteens with water. As far as Sitton was concerned, this was another Aiwamba. He had been to Aiwamba 2 or 3 times. The people there, he said, knew him and loved him. On his visits there, they showered him with food and hospitality, even offering him a house to live in on a permanent basis. opposite and told these Agati men our story. We had come many days. We had abandoned our rice because we could not get carriers. We were weak, tired, and hungry. We were happy to be here among good people. There was much hugging, hand shaking, and back patting. The old man in the purple shirt, whom we later learned was affectionately called Maswara because of his loquacious, happy-go-lucky nature, had taken out a big mambu, or bamboo smoking pipe. It was a large bamboo cylinder with a little tube jutting out from the side near the bottom where a roll of tobacco was inserted. We pleaded fatigue at last and crept into the back room to spread our sleeping bags and rest. Later, we could talk at length, establish friendships, explain our mission, and tomorrow or the next day, get carriers and a new guide and go on to Aiwamba. The boys milled around beside us, making their beds on the springy pit floor. Sitton and I made ours against the far wall, comfortable at last to be in a house, in a cool climate, among friendly people, where there would be rest and food. We spoke together in the tones of partners who had just weathered all manner of hardship and arrived successfully at their destination. We also spoke with the conspiratorial glee of hungry men who have kept a canned ham in their pack for a future date and who suddenly found themselves face to face with the future. We considered eating the ham then, but rejected the idea and talked about our plans for the rest of the trip. Sitton was for going on to Aiwamba tomorrow, but I wanted to stay on an extra day in Engati. "Man, I'll probably never get back here again," I told him. "I don't want to just rush off. I came halfway around the world to see this." He tentatively agreed. We calculated that it would take about 2 days to reach Aiwamba, but really we did not know. Later we would talk to the natives here and find out more information. Also, we would get carriers and a guide to take us there. Unlike Marilinen, here we were among friends, some of whom presumably were church members, and if they were anything like their kinsmen in Aiwamba, they would readily help us. Our minds were free and easy. It felt good to have the road so open before us after all the uncertainty of the past days, and we would not have Alice there with us like a thorn under the skin. We would not be at the mercy of his lies anymore. We would find a solid, friendly, honest, dependable guide. Let's say it would take 2 days to reach Aiwamba. All right, true. We were tired and had little food, but we could get a bunch of cow here, and in Aiwamba they would feed us well. So in Aiwamba, minus Alice and two of the boys, who would stay in Engati as temporary resident missionaries, we once again would rest, eat, and make friendly talk with natives. This for a day, maybe two. Then we would get a new batch of carriers and go on to Menyamya Station. Sitton had walked that route before. He knew the trail. It was an open kunya country with clear views. No more jungle, tangling vines, stinging salate, thorns, mosquitoes, and leeches. It would take a day and a half, maybe 2 full days. In Menyamya Station, we would catch the first bush plane to Lehi. The station had a bush airstrip, school, church, and government station. But about a day out of Aiwamba, before you get to Menyamya Station, there was a river which might well be a tributary to the Watat. If so, and if the river were navigable, maybe we would build a raft or buy a canoe and float it down to Lehi. That could be a very pleasant and exciting trip. But we would have to ask natives there about the river's course, making certain the river did not, in fact, run out on the other side of the island, the Port Moresby side. That would be a fix. In any event, we certainly were not going to go back the way we had come. Too far, too hard. 2 days, indeed. Sitton expressed irritation with the fellow who had given us that information. We calculated the number of hours we had actually spent walking. It amounted to well over 40. 46, I believe. 46 hours of walking in 2 days in those mountains? No one could manage that. Not even Alice. So it was decided that we would either float or fly back to Lehi. Anyway, we'd stay here at least tonight and probably tomorrow, and then the next day leave for Awamba. I would be glad to get out of the jungle and into open Kunya again. Kunya gives you a certain sense of freedom. In Kunya, you are free to walk where you wish. You can see for miles. You know where you are. If you lose the trail, you can follow a compass, a bearing. In the jungle, you are a prisoner of the trail, of the guide. You see nothing, can go nowhere except where the trail goes. You're a blind mole, tunneling in the dirt. Sitting stretched out for a nap, I wrote in my journal, read more of Osborne Russell's Trapper's Journal. No longer did the lives of the fur trappers in the Rocky Mountains seem so astonishing. In fact, life there and then seemed to have certain advantages over wilderness travel here in New Guinea. There you could see you were not imprisoned by the jungle. You were not a slave to malaria and malaria pills. And moreover, Osborne Russell and his fellow trappers had guns, something we lacked. Even now, with the happy outcome of our patrol and the friendly nature of these Ngati villagers, I heartily wished for a gun. With a gun, the abandoning of our food would not have been such a drastic step. I could have shot birds. Maybe I could have shot one of the Murugs. A gun provides its bearer with a certain authority, a certain self-reliance in the wilderness. No food, no guide. All right, at least I can live off the land for a while. Angry natives, well, at least I've got a chance. But for now, there were apparently no angry natives. We had food and should have no trouble finding a guide. So when at last I tired of the Rockies, I put the book down and lay back quietly, listening to the mountain breeze blowing through the cracks of the hut. Later in the afternoon, I got up and went back into the front room. The two men were still there, along with some women and children. The fire crackled. The pipe puffed. Another man had come in, a young, smiling fellow, perhaps 20 years old. He was dressed in traditional Menyamya garb, virtually the same outfit described in McCarthy's journals. There was a bushy, grass loincloth and a cape of beaten bark tied around the neck and at the waist so it fell down the back and covered the buttocks, yet could be pulled up over the head in rain. A wealth of shells, reeds, and beads hung around the neck and chest, some worn as necklaces, others slung over one shoulder like an artillery belt. Around the forehead was a sash of scarlet cloth, and on this sash a headband beaded with small shells and adorned with feathers. Small pig tusks, tightly bound together, were stuck through the nose.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.